listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
All eyes were on Buenos Aires Thursday, as leaders from around the world assembled for this weekend's upcoming G20 summit. One question hanging over the meeting is whether or not the incident this past weekend off of Crimea between the Russian and Ukrainian navies would dampen the chances of a meeting between U.S. President Trump and Russia's President Vladimir Putin. Dan Ashby filed this report from Moscow for China's global television network, CGTN.
Trump initially came out saying that he might not go to the meeting with President Putin because he was so concerned about what had happened in Ukraine and he needed more information. But now we've had the Russian side actually coming out and naming a date, December the 1st, as when the meeting will happen, saying it is scheduled. Also listing the agenda, saying it will include North Korea, Syria, the Iran nuclear deal, the INF nuclear treaty. So I think the Russians are trying to calm things down, pin that date down and say it is going to happen. But there's no doubt that the Ukraine maritime clash has complicated things here because the US accuses Russia of aggression because its ships shot at and captured three Ukrainian vessels which were sailing near its territory. Ukraine, of course, denies that it's done anything wrong, but Russia says it was in the right, that it didn't break any laws. Dmitry Peskov, President Putin's spokesman, saying he disagreed with the US. But here's what President Trump had to say on it earlier.
We do not like what's happening either way. We don't like what's happening, and hopefully it'll get straightened out. I know Europe is not, they are not thrilled. They're working on it too. We're all working on it together.
So that tension on that particular issue is really going to make things a little more difficult, particularly when they have the big issue of the INF nuclear treaty to talk about. That is the landmark Soviet-US nuclear treaty limiting medium-range missiles, seen as a cornerstone of strategic stability. President Trump says he wants to drop out, but President Putin is going to try to go in and salvage it. At the moment, the odds don't seem good because President Trump seems set on his way, saying he's going to formalize his dropout. out. So President Putin says all the options are on the table, but a lot now hangs in the balance at this meeting. If it does happen, it certainly will be crunch talks. Dan Ashby, CGTN, Moscow.
With more information on the positions of the two sides, we have this report from CGTN's Wasnaychet Bolden.
Both Russia and Ukraine have differing versions of the event, and each blames other for the face-off. First, let's look at the facts. On Sunday, two Ukrainian gunboats and a tug were sailing between Odessa in the Black Sea and Mariupol in the Azov Sea. The waterway that connects those two ports in the Kerch Strait between Crimea and Russia's mainland. Russia blocked them by placing a tanker under the newly built Kerch Bridge. The ships were then seized by its forces. Russia also scrambled two fighter jets and two helicopters to the area. Now here are the two versions of the event. The Ukrainian Navy claims that its boats were fired upon and seized as they tried to leave the area. It said 23 Ukrainians were on board and 6 crew members were injured. Russia admits that one of the patrol boats used force to seize the vessels, but claims that only 3 sailors were hurt. Kiev asserts that it notified Moscow in advance about the movement of the ships, but Moscow denies that it was given a warning. It accused Ukraine of violating international law in a pre-planned provocation.
The Russian claims about violation of the Russian border by the Ukrainian naval ships is an outright lie.
Under the 2003 treaty, vessels from both sides enjoy freedom of navigation in the area. But Russia says the treaty is very specific about following certain rules and regulations at the Crimean seaport of Kerch. It accuses Ukrainian ships of not following due procedure. But Ukrainian accuses Russia of blocking access to the Kerch Strait and describes the seizure as another act of armed aggression. Russia disputes this, saying it had no option but to fire at the vessels.
We consider such steps as a violation of Russia's sovereignty. These illegal acts meant that Russian customs vessels had to use force.
Tensions are growing between the two sides over access to the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov. Ukraine says Russia is trying to occupy the Azov Sea and damage Ukraine's economy by blocking access to two important ports. With Nayan said, Wang Xuan for CGTN.
This past weekend's incident in the Black Sea was the subject of discussion at Tuesday's State Department briefing with State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert.
Russia has rejected the idea of direct talks with Ukraine. What is the U.S. doing? Is the U.S. concerned that this might escalate out of control?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to comment on a hypothetical, but obviously what happened over the weekend was a serious escalation. It's a dangerous escalation on the part of Russians' continued aggressive behavior against Ukraine. The United States continues to support Ukraine's territorial integrity. The Secretary and the President both have a very strong relationship with the government in Ukraine, President Poroshenko in particular. Some of you may be aware the Secretary spoke with President Poroshenko yesterday, offering our support and expressing our concern over that dangerous aggressive act on the part of Russia. The Secretary is heading to NATO, as many of you know, in the coming days. I would imagine that that would be a big topic of conversation. NATO issued a very strongly worded statement earlier today. I would encourage you to take a look at that. Among the things that the U.S. government is doing, you saw Ambassador Haley's comments yesterday at the United Nations. The Secretary then had a call with President Poroshenko. We put out a statement ourselves, and we're continuing to have conversations not only with NATO, but with the OSCE and other multilateral organizations who share our concerns. Now, one of the things I think you'll be seeing in the days and weeks ahead are additional conversations that the U.S. government is having with our European allies. And one of the things that we would like to see take place is our European allies doing more to assist Ukraine. The United States government has taken a very strong position in their support. In support of Ukraine, we would like other countries to do more as well. That is something that's enshrined in our national security strategy, encouraging other countries to help one another around the world so that the United States isn't completely I don't want to say shouldering the burden, but so the United States isn't handling these issues chiefly alone. Now, you may ask, what can European governments do? Many governments have imposed sanctions on Russia for its actions in Crimea, in Ukraine. Not all of those sanctions, as I have been told and our experts have explained to me, have been fully enforced. So that is one thing that we can look for European countries to do more when we talk about doing more. Also, something we've talked about a fair amount, but perhaps not enough, is Nord Stream 2. Nord Stream 2 is snaking through many of these countries, and I think that's a question European countries have to ask themselves. Is Nord Stream 2 something that they want to continue with because it helps the Russian government, and is that the kind of support that they want to provide the Russian government with continuing to back Nord Stream 2 at this time?
Ukraine didn't sneak into NATO over the past two weeks without anyone noticing, did they? I'm just curious as to why you kept mentioning
it. It's a shared concern, and I just mentioned that NATO put out a very strong statement about its concerns, and so I think this is a issue that many countries around the world are concerned about.
Yes, I get that. But the point of my lead into the question is, are you envisioning, even though Ukraine is not a member of NATO, that there would be a step, something that NATO could do as an alliance?
I think it is important anytime that countries come together and express their serious concern. It was a Ukraine commission. They have something, NATO does, that's called a Ukraine commission, and they held an emergency session yesterday, which they largely condemned Russia's actions in Ukraine.
But, I mean, are you saying that...
I can't speak for NATO, but I can tell you that a lot of these countries are concerned as allies.
I'm asking you if the U.S. government is pushing a NATO response to the incident over the weekend, even though Ukraine is not a member.
Matt, I don't have any information for you on that, okay?
Is the U.S. pushing this response to G20? Is this going to be a message to G20 of pressuring more action
to bring pressure on Russia?
Yeah, I'm not going to get ahead of anything that the president may or may not discuss when he's at the G20. We look forward to being there in support of the president, and I just refer you back to the White House for anything on that, okay?
There are certainly some in Washington, D.C., who hope that the latest incident will provoke more tension between the U.S. and Russia. For more than 2 years, the Democratic Party and most of the U.S. corporate media have been waging a nonstop campaign to blame Russia for just about everything that goes on in the U.S. Ron Ridenour is a longtime activist and author now living in Denmark, whose latest book is entitled The Russian Peace Threat, Pentagon on Alert. He spoke with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford this past weekend.
For more than 2 years, the Democratic Party and most of the U.S. corporate media have been waging a non-stop campaign to blame Russia for the myriad social and political conflicts that plague the United States. They call their conspiracy theory Russiagate. Ridenour says there's nothing the U.S. military-industrial complex fears more than the prospect of world peace. He says the whole Russiagate affair is a misinformation campaign concocted by former CIA Director John Brennan to rekindle the Cold War.
Peace is not an issue for the United States of America. I read somebody's comprehensive analysis of U.S. wars. I'm often writing about U.S. wars, and this person came up with 12 years since the beginning of the United States of America's liberation from England's colonies. It's only 12 years the United States has not been at war. We're talking about maybe 650 wars or minor wars or major military interventions in the history of the United States. And, of course, it starts with the Native Americans, the Indians, the 300-year war against the Indians. There are 30 million Indians in North America, not including Mexico, when the Europeans came. And at 1900, there were 400,000 left. So peace is fake news. And the United States needs war. That's why it's the policeman of the world. The Danish media here, which I, of course, read and sometimes contribute to or have in the past, they don't like to take my stuff any longer. They openly, you know, endorse and support the United States as the world's policeman. And they think that this protects them somehow.
But in the modern era, with Russiagate, this anti-Russian hysteria. Russia has been put in the center of U.S. crosshairs in ways that were not possible since the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. But, I mean, you know, the Yeltsin, they couldn't make a war against Yeltsin. I mean, he was their alcoholic lackey. He, with Clinton and Wall Street, plundered Russia. The 10 years that he was the leader, there was a tremendous reaction against some political errors or mistakes or sins of the communist era, the Soviet Union era. That's a long discussion on what are sins and what are mistakes and why they were made. But there was a reaction, and the United States came in, as they always will, and took advantage and basically captured Yeltsin and the economy of that country. So they had no need to make war against Russia at that point. They emptied its gold reserves entirely. The length of life fell 5 years in just the 10-year period. Putin came along and he said, well, you know, I'm no commie and I'm no longer in the KGB. There's no KGB. I want peace in the world. I basically just want sovereignty for my country, like many other leaders have wanted, whether we like them or not. People like Hussein and people like Gaddafi and Assad and many in Latin America. So that was his greatest sin right from the beginning. He even offered Bush, when 9/11 occurred, he offered him intelligence support to fly over his territory. He did a lot to encourage a friendship at the cost of lives in Afghanistan. You know, it's not like Putin, in my eyes, is any tremendous saint. But the good thing with him was that he wanted to take his country back, and he began to do it. And the economy improved with capitalism. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, a communist economy or anything like that. And that, of course, angered Wall Street and the Pentagon and the deep state, CIA. So that's why Russiagate exists today. There, of course, many things happened since 2000 when he became the president. But it's logical that designed to dominate the world. I mean, that's what globalization means. It's another word for imperialism, but it's an imperialism that will totally dominate the entire world. I live in a little previously peaceful country. I mean, everybody that knows just a little about Denmark and Scandinavia has thought, well, it's tolerant, it's peaceful. They've made a vassal state of all of Europe. There's 500,000 troops in Europe, hundreds of military bases. In Europe, after the Second World War, you know, still here.
And the anti-Russian drumbeat got a lot louder under Barack Obama. His Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, called Putin Hitler, which is the kind of talk that you don't do in civil, polite society, much less in diplomacy.
No, it's ridiculous that anybody can compare Putin with Hitler. I mean, who has he killed? I mean, we're talking about a man, Hitler, you know, who's responsible for the deaths of 50 to 80 million people, 6 million Jews, a million gypsies, etc. I mean, Putin hasn't even, it's not in Putin's agenda. There have been some local warfare within this the sphere of the Russian territory, what used to be Russian republics. You know, Russia has 12 bases outside of its own territory. 10 of them are in previous republics. Two or three of them only have radar stations. China, for example, has one military base outside of China in a little land in Africa near a base. It was a French colony. France has a military base, and U.S. has a military base.
In Djibouti.
Yes. And the general in charge of AFROCOM, you know, he wants to have troops, U.S. troops, and U.S. military bases in every African nation. I think there's 56. And Obama started to get military troops and bases in some of those lands. So, I mean, the United States has at least 800 military bases in the world outside of 4,000 military bases in the United States itself in every U.S. state. I mean, we're talking about gigantic mathematical numbers here where it's just absurd to begin to compare. The last statistics on the official U.S. budget for military is around $800 billion now, but it's about $1.2 trillion. But even if you take the official U.S. budget, that is 12 times what the Russian budget is. If you take the unofficial budget, it's 18 times. If you take all of the military budgets of all of the countries that are U.S. allies, the Commonwealth, the EU, the Europe, and NATO, we're talking about such a gigantic gap between them and the three or four countries that U.S. has on its current war list, that it's absurd to think that anybody in China or Russia would begin to be aggressive against the United States.
And in fact, the increase in the U.S. military budget of this year over last year is bigger than the entire total Russian military budget.
Right. You know, it's unfortunate. Of course, I'm no Trump fan, but actually Trump, you see the difference between Trump and most of the capitalists, or at least many of the capitalists, and those that support the Democratic Party, as well as many that support the Republican Party, is that he earned his profits by super exploiting the domestic working class, by and large. He made his money from buildings, and buildings have to exist in a particular place. And so most of these buildings were in the United States, or are in the United States. So he was not thinking, when he went into politics, like a normal imperialist, you know, like going abroad and dominating everything. He was not at that point connected to the weapons industry. Well, just like every president that gets elected, the first day in office, the real leaders come into the Oval Office and they tell the new sitting president what the world is all about and what they demand. And so everybody in the military-industrial complex told Trump that he could not continue to be president if he didn't have some wars, you know. I mean, Bush had two wars. Obama ended up with seven. So, you know, Trump maybe didn't want to have too many wars, and he didn't want to have wars with Putin. And in fact, some companies that supported him, including Exxon, thought that they could make profit by not going to war with Russia, that they could be partners in the Arctic area with oil. You know, they could jointly make profits from trading with each other around oil. So, you know, but Trump had to break his initial thoughts and go with the military-industrial complex. Every president has. They killed Kennedy. Not that I'm a Kennedy fan. He was also an imperialist, but he was a rather clever and intelligent one. And he wanted to get out of the Vietnam War, and he wanted to change relations with Cuba because he came to the rational conclusion that a nuclear war would only be the way that you could perhaps win, but you wouldn't win when most of the Americans were also dead. So when he began to pull out, the CIA and the, you know, military-industrial complex murdered him. So this could have happened to Trump as well. Why not?
Vladimir Putin is an extremely popular politician in Russia, and yet people in the United States continually call him a dictator.
Well, long live dictators. I mean, Plato said, you know, what is the best political system? Plato's answer was a benevolent dictator. I lived here and worked in Cuba for 8 years. I've written 6 books about it. I even got to know Fidel Castro a little bit. He read one of my books and signed his name, and now I'm patting myself on the back. But I'm telling you that Fidel Castro, in many eyes, is a dictator, was a dictator. Well, depending upon how you want to define dictator, let's say he was. I mean, the electoral process there would take another interview with me to explain. It's not all that simple. But there's no doubt about it that the masses of people wanted him where he was. And he, under his time in Cuba, you know, nobody died of starvation in Cuba. Everybody had, quote, free education and free health care. Of course, you pay for this with your wages. You pay for this by being a worker. The Cuban people had a much, much better life all those years than they ever did before the Socialist Revolution occurred. We can find throughout history people who have been strong men, who have been able to be successful in creating a decent society for the masses of people.
But Russia has multi-party elections, and Putin comes out way on top every time he runs.
Right. There were 7 other political parties that ran against his party, including the Communist Party, which comes in second all the time. They do not contend that he's a dictator. At any rate, Putin is the man that the Russian people need, and Putin is the man that the whole world needs. He is the epitome of a dove. And my book starts with another dove, you know, with Yuri Gagarin, first man to go around the world. And at that time, Khrushchev was the peace man, the man who saved the world, one of the Russians who saved the world from a nuclear annihilation the year after Yuri went around the world. Well, Khrushchev sent Yuri around the world with a peace dove on his uniform often, you know, saying we have to have peace. Bobby Kennedy was sent by Robert Kennedy to tell the Russian prime minister that if they did not take their bombs away from Cuba, that was on a Friday, by Monday, there was no way that the military-industrial complex could be stopped from bombing Cuba and Russia. Now, Russia has never done that. Russia has never threatened anybody with a nuclear war. So I don't care, Vexy, you know, how you want to define the leaders. There's no democratic leadership in the United States' history. Everybody that has been in the president is there to support Wall Street and the military-industrial complex. You can't be president of the United States unless you have many millions of dollars behind you. You and I could never be president of the United States.
So why does the U.S. corporate media and the Democratic Party not let Russiagate go away, despite the fact that they have not come up with any proof of the predicate crime, collusion?
Well, I mean, you don't need any proof. I mean, Goebbels didn't any proof. They agree with Goebbels. You know, you tell a lie, you tell a very big lie, and you tell it over and over again, and it becomes the truth. I mean, how many people in the world, despite all of the possibilities we have today with communication, with the IT world, how many people will devote the time that you and I devote to try to figure out what the hell is really going on? You know, most people are workers. They have families. You and I probably spend many, many hours every week just to try to find out what lie are they telling us and how are they doing it and what is really the truth. And who is the corporate media? I mean, the corporate media, of course, is owned by the corporations. You know, the same people that own the media also are involved in other enterprises, including weaponry. The weaponry is what you can't have peace and democracy as long as you have a weapon industry that must thrive on profits like every other capitalist concern. And you can't have profits in the weapon industry unless you have wars. You have to use all those bullets. What they're doing with Russiagate is not just against Russia. And not just threatening the world war and nuclear world war, they are dismantling the solidarity of people. The so-called progressives were once for peace, too, the white progressives. I mean, now you've got white progressives involved with supporting Russiagate. You've got this so-called socialist Bernie Sanders. I mean, he's a traitor to everything that he was supposed to have stood for. He and I were together, not that we knew each other, in Mississippi in 64. He was a good guy then. Why does he have to come out to be an imperialist? Well, you know, that's you obviously win elections that way. You obviously get money for your campaigns that way. Bernie Sanders only opposed one war. That was Iraq. And then after he said no to the Iraq war, he voted every time to send weapons and troops to Iraq. And these so-called people, these so-called democratic socialists, they're the same way.
Some people say that Russiagate has inaugurated a new McCarthyism. Well, I think you're old enough to remember at least some of the latter parts of the old McCarthyism.
Well, it certainly is. When I started being an activist, it was in 61. The Bay of Pigs got me involved. I'd been in the military. I saw it with my father. We listened to the radio in 56 when the Hungarian conflict occurred. And Soviet troops came into Hungary. We know in hindsight, anyway, that the CIA was very much involved in making chaos and uproar in Hungary. Well, at that point, I was, you know, an American dreamer, and I quit high school and went into the military. I was sent to Japan, and on the military bases there, a radar base, it was totally segregated. White soldiers went around on that base in full uniform with a baseball cap on their head with KKK engraved in it. The barracks were segregated. When I came out of that, I began to wake up. What is it? What's going on here? What's going on? So when they invaded Cuba, I started to really protest. I remember Steve Allen. He was against the war. Every time he made a speech, he had to start by saying, I am not a communist. I am not a communist. This was at the end of the McCarthy period, and still it was so important that if you wanted to criticize some important policies of the United States government, you had to be very clean. You had to not be a communist. Well, communism fundamentally, I mean, at least the power of communism in the state sense, is not happening right now. So you got to have a new enemy. Now, you don't start your talks or your discussions with, I'm not a communist. You have to say, I'm not a fan of Putin.
The nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, reports for Prison Radio on the twilight of U.S. empire.
The Trump era, when it finally passes from the stage of history, will not pass either easily nor willingly. It will have left the aura of anxiety, the pangs of paranoia, and the air of enmity. It will be bitter, nasty, and mean, and it will not end with death. It will leave a stench of anger, of hatred, and sourness that will long dwell in the national unconscious, as well as the memory of the world. Such will be the legacy of Trump. Such will be the unworthy inheritance of the American empire. For the better part of a century, America played the role of protector of the weak and benefactor of the world's oppressed. But that was when the world was a bipolar one. The fall of the Soviet Union made the world unipolar, the world's sole superpower. And with that reality emerged the U.S. without a peer and without a mask. We saw then its true, angry, contemptuous face, snarling at the Third World, hostile to its European ancestors, and dismissive of Latin America. That's because an empire needs no allies, nor any friends. It needs subjects. It needs satraps. For empires are political, economic, and military machines of dominance and exploitation. Its power is its only justification for being. It matters little whether Trump completes the full 8 years of two terms or is there for the next 8 months. The die is cast. The empire has sat its utter contempt upon the world. The damage is done. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Future historians may look back at Donald Trump's handling of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi as a case study of the lack of leadership and outright folly. His reasons for giving the Saudis, or rather the Crown Prince, a free pass simply don't make sense. Why? Because it's all about Iran. Cross-talking Trump and Saudi Arabia, I'm joined by my guest, Hamid Mousavi in Tehran. He's a professor of political science at the University of Tehran. In London, we have Jonathan Steele. He's an international affairs commentator. And in Leeds, we have Afshin Shahi. He is a senior lecturer in Middle East politics at the University of Bradford. All right, gentlemen, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Jonathan, let me go to you first in London. How do you react to the liberal media's treatment of Donald Trump vis-a-vis his statements regarding the Crown Prince, the murder of Khashoggi, and Yemen, and I guess also Iran? Go ahead, Jonathan.
Well, attacking him for not doing enough to cut relations with Saudi Arabia or in some way to punish the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for his apparent involvement in this terrible affair But, I mean, there's an element of hypocrisy because the U.S. has had relations with Saudi Arabia for years, and they've done some terrible things. In fact, the whole invasion of Yemen would have been a good case, much more important than the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, for cutting down on relations. But instead of that, they're actually supporting the invasion of Yemen.
Hamid, let's go to Tehran here. Let me read you something that Donald Trump said in the last few days here. Saudi Arabia would gladly withdraw from Yemen if the Iranians would agree to leave. They would immediately provide desperately needed humanitarian assistance. Additionally, Saudi Arabia has agreed to spend billions of dollars in leading the fight against radical Islamic terrorism. Do you make any sense of any of those words? Go ahead, in Tehran.
I think those words are actually very ridiculous because Iran has no physical presence in Yemen. I mean, yes, Iran has supported the Houthis before, but there's been such a blockade on Yemen that Iran doesn't have the necessary means to even send humanitarian aid, let alone be physically present there. With regards to Yemen, I think we're witnessing the worst humanitarian crisis since World War II. I mean, Save the Children, which is a British charity, just announced that 85,000 children under the age of 5 years old have died out of starvation in the past 3 years. And essentially, we're seeing a blind eye being shown, especially by the American, towards what the Saudis are doing. Not only that, but they have also helped the Saudis both in terms of refueling their aircraft as well as intelligence sharing. Regarding the issue of Islamic terrorism, we have to again remember that 15 out of the 19 hijackers on the 9/11 terrorist attacks were Saudi nationals. So how can the Saudis be fighting terrorism when they are the root of terrorism in the region and they have been fomenting the most extreme form of Islam, which is Wahhabism, and they have spread it all across the world. So I don't think those statements by Trump make any sense.
I have a very strong sense that Mr. Bolton may have written those words for the president here. Afshin, let me go to you in Leeds. I agree with Jonathan Steele. I mean, the hypocrisy of criticizing Trump when you can look at every, you know, since the Second World War, the number of dictators that the United States has protected and funded and given legitimacy. So, I mean, I really don't take the Washington Post and the New York Times very seriously on this. But what I think is serious here is if there is no pushback against the Saudis for being involved in this horrific crime, then it's actually enabling the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia that he can actually do anything he wants now. There will be no punishment whatsoever. Go ahead in Leeds.
Yes, it seems that Saudi Arabia, at least from the United States, is not going to receive any punishment. And I completely agree with your guest, Jonathan. There is a huge element of hypocrisy here. But I think it would be a good idea to kind of examine why, for this specific case, Donald Trump is absolutely determined to support and back up Mohammed bin Salman. First of all, I think we still haven't completely exhausted why Mohammed bin Salman decided to kill Khashoggi. And actually, if we shed more light on this, perhaps at least to a degree, we could understand why Donald Trump is 100% determined to cost this case. I strongly believe that it is a little bit naive and simplistic and reductionist to assume that Mohammed bin Salman went through all that to kill Jamal Khashoggi simply because he was criticizing the Saudi establishment, simply because he was criticizing his foreign policy in the region. Although this has been kind of the prevailing narrative over the last few weeks, but I think there is an element of truth which is missing in this equation. Although I cannot kind of verify it and prove it 100%, but I strongly think that actually Jamal Khashoggi was killed not because he was criticizing the Saudi establishment, but simply he was killed because perhaps he knew too much.
That's a very good point, because, you know, he's being betrayed in Western media as some kind of dissident, but he was really, in many ways, the ultimate insider as well here. Jonathan, one of the interesting things that we've seen here is that we've had a number of senators, Lindsey Graham, for example, come out and say the most demeaning things you could possibly say about a person. And then we have the CIA coming out with its high confidence message. I hate that phrase, but that they believe that the trail goes all the way back to the Crown Prince. It seems to me that this is being picked up as a domestic political issue in the United States to go after Trump. What do you think?
Well, there is an element of that. And of course, there is a difference of view between the CIA and President Trump on the question of Russian involvement in this famous election of 2016, etc. So Trump is already against the intelligence agencies on some other big issues. And so this is part of the ongoing war. But I mean, just to come back to your initial point about the nonsensical statements that Trump has made, let's not forget that as recently as 2011, Trump was quoted as saying that Saudi Arabia is the world's biggest funder of terrorism.
Yeah.
And they're using petrodollars, our own money, to fund terrorists who are shooting and killing our own people. I mean, yep. He's done a complete 180-degree turn now. Suddenly, Saudi Arabia's okay. Yep.
Yeah, having that Twitter archive can be a bit troublesome at times. Let's go back to Tehran. One of the things I find interesting, one of the reasons why Trump is still speaking about Saudi Arabia in the most superlative terms, I mean, it is quite bizarre if you look at his Twitter feed, but it's really his administration has made it very clear that the country that you reside in right now is a target, and moving Israel and the Saudis along with their plans for, let's just say it, regime change in Tehran, they have to stick with the Saudis because they're an integral part of that plan. As bothersome and as troublesome as it is, Washington has chosen Saudi Arabia to be a key pillar in their anti-Iran policy. Go ahead.
So they have been using Saudi Arabia, the Americans have been using Saudi Arabia as a proxy, if you will, to essentially confront Iran. Nevertheless, this hasn't been very successful under Donald Trump.
Yep.
Rather than isolating Iran, they have actually isolated it themselves. When they decided to leave the nuclear deal, aside from Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Israel, virtually the entire international community was against this move. And nearly the entire international community is supporting Iran and the nuclear deal to stay in place. So it hasn't been very successful. Also, I think we have to consider the downsides of supporting the Saudis. Now, when Mohammed bin Salman came into power, we have to remember that killing Khashoggi wasn't the first reckless behavior from them. I mean, he started to arrest his political opponents in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. The Americans stayed silent. They didn't do anything. They implemented a blockade on Qatar. They didn't do anything. They kidnapped a Lebanese prime minister and forced him to resign. Still, the Americans gave him a free pass. And even with Canada, when they cut relations with Canada over just a single tweet that criticized Saudi Arabia over human rights, again, the Americans didn't support the Canadians, which are their natural ally. So essentially, they allowed the Saudis under the reign of Mohammed bin Salman to continue with this reckless behavior, the latest instance of which is the killing of Khashoggi. And as a result of that, even if they weren't directly involved in the killing, I think they share a major responsibility in it.
Absolutely. Afshin, let me go back to you in Leeds here. You know, and I want to talk about this in the second half of the program as well, is what does the United States get out of its strategic relationship with Saudi Arabia, other than headaches, it seems? Go ahead.
I think we have to really differentiate between the United States and Donald Trump. Over the last 6 or 7 months, a number of well-established American media have been talking about the fact and the ways in which Donald Trump have been using, or I better say, abusing his position as the President of the United States in order to expand his existing business empire. According to some reliable reports, in 2017 alone, the Trump companies at least sold $35 million worth of real estate to shell companies, which were kind of systematically obscuring the buyers. And I very much believe a lot of those kind of obscure buyers were probably from Saudi Arabia, or at least have some connection to the kingdom. I have very little doubt that actually Donald Trump has some personal interest in kind of keeping this warm relationship between Washington.
It's a very interesting theory. We're about to go to the break, but I think one thing is absolutely clear. The neocons that he surrounded himself with, they're driving his policy here. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Trump and Saudi Arabia. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Jonathan in London here. I suppose it's the biggest problem in many ways is that it's really the United States doesn't have a relationship with Saudi Arabia. Rather, it has with this royal family. And this is what makes the relations very difficult. I mean, there is speculation that, as I mentioned earlier, the CIA, with its report, placing essentially blame on the crown prince. But it's widely speculated that the CIA doesn't really like the crown prince very much, and they would have preferred another candidate. And as I said before we went to the break here, the people that Trump has surrounded himself with, they definitely have something for Iran in mind, okay? And Saudi Arabia is part of the team. And whatever it takes to get, you know, the neocons' agenda to fruition, they're willing to accept. I think that's why when our guest in Tehran mentioned all of these failures of the crown prince, that's why they're overlooking them. Okay, this is really the case here. Do you think there's a play, Jonathan, for family change, not necessarily regime change?
Well, I mean, if they had Mohammed bin Nayef, who was previously the top sort of security person in Riyadh, he would have been better, more low-key and so on. But it doesn't change the basic parameters of the huge, deep relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. I think it's not just because they're using Saudi Arabia against Iran, and Saudi Arabia's very willingly going along with that. They don't need much persuasion. There are two other big factors. One, of course, is the arms sales, the huge billion-dollar sales of American weapons to Saudi Arabia, which helps the American economy. But the third very big issue is the question of Israel.
Of course.
There's already, they want to do what is now being called normalization, which is to get the Arab countries to start normalizing their relations with Israel, first on a commercial basis, intelligence sharing, then political and then diplomatic, to allow Israel to have a much freer hand in the Middle East. And there have already been reports of under the table contacts between the Saudi intelligence people and the Israeli intelligence people. And we've seen how Netanyahu went to Oman recently, and there are other contacts with Arab countries as well in the Gulf. So that's really the huge thing. If they could get Saudi Arabia to come out openly and declare that Israel was a normal state and they could have diplomatic relations with it, that would be a huge prize for Donald Trump and the neocons.
Yeah, and let me go back to Tehran. And that would be a very big prize for Jared, because apparently that's part of his grand settlement for the Middle East there. But I don't know. I mean, if I were in the Trump White House, I would see the trials and tribulations of Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister. He's in a tight spot politically. He's acting foreign minister. I'm sorry, defense minister right now. So, you know, you have this normalization of relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel. Do you think that agenda will work in trying to isolate Iran in the region? Because basically it's a Sunni-Shia thing they're trying to play here. Go ahead, Tehran.
Yes, but the fact is that the Trump family, and especially Jared Kushner, have invested so much in Mohammed bin Salman that it's very difficult to undermine him or change him right now. I mean, U.S. media actually reported that the list of princes that were arrested in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, the rivals of Mohammed bin Salman, the list was actually given to MBS by Jared Kushner, and that's how close they are. The problem is, however, that the issue of normalization colonization of Arab countries with Israel is not a Sunni Shia thing. It's actually a issue of the Palestinians. The position of the Saudis has always been under Fahd and under Abdullah that they would only normalize relations when a fair solution to the Palestinian problem would be found. And the problem we're having right now is this normalization is happening without any sort of solution for the Palestinians. In fact, the Palestinian situation has even gotten worse. For example, when the Oslo negotiations and settlement happened in the early 1990s, there were only 130,000 settlers living in the occupied territories. Today, there is over 500,000. So the two-state solution has essentially died. And we have to remember that the issue of normalization with Israel is also very unpopular in the Muslim world. So it's actually going to be a very difficult task, both for MBS and for Jared Kushner.
Yeah, well, Afshin, you know, it's not the first time the West has used elite capture to get its way, and I agree. If there is such a thing as an Arab street, you better check in with it before you start that. But there is a normalization already of relations, maybe not so publicly, but between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Is the U.S. wise, and I'm not just saying Trump now, but the U.S. in general, is it wise to put all its eggs in one basket, I mean, on this relationship between Saudi Arabia and Israel? What is the downside? Because I don't see a whole lot of upside. Go ahead, Afshin and Leeds.
I mean, if you look at kind of the essence of Trump's foreign policy over the last years, it seems that he has kind of this very extreme Iran-centric approach to effectively change everything within the political landscape in the Middle East. He believes that actually Iran is the ultimate source of trouble and American insecurity in the region, and in order to resist Iranian position in the Middle East, he has to kind of create this alliance, this triangle between Washington, Tel Aviv, and Riyadh. And it is not surprising at all over the last 3 or 4 weeks when effectively every important politician have been kind of expressing some concern about the situation, particularly when we realized that there was a direct connection between the Saudi establishment and the killing of Jamal Khashoggi in Tel Aviv, in Israel. Basically, people like Netanyahu constantly said that, yes, what happened was not nice, but at the same time, Israel and the future of what they call stability and security in the Middle East requires the continuous position of Mohammed bin Salman. So if we look at kind of the position of American foreign policy within this very specific context, at least to them, it does make sense to maintain this alliance in order to constitute a meaningful pressure against Iran.
Well, all I can say, let me go to Jonathan here right now. Over the last 15 years or so, the more the West and its proxies in the region try to isolate Iran, the more powerful Iran gets. I really don't understand. There's no learning curve. These people just don't learn here. Jonathan, one of the most tragic things, I think, for me, and I've made it a point on this program to continue discussing what's going on in Yemen. It took the murder of Khashoggi to actually get it, the Yemen story into the mainstream media, and it was about time here. What worries me is by giving dictators a free pass is nothing new, okay, at all. All right, but in this case here, isn't it enabling Saudi Arabia's horrific, murderous policy vis-a-vis Yemen to go unchecked?
It is indeed, and it is going on unchecked. I mean, the United States has made some little minor adjustments. They said they won't help with the in-flight refueling of Saudi aircraft that are bombing in Yemen, but only about 20% of the flights involve U.S. refueling, so the 80% is still going ahead. The U.S. also has been calling for a ceasefire, but that's easily done unless you put some diplomatic clout behind it and threaten to withdraw help from Mohammed bin Salman. He's never going to agree to a ceasefire. So there have been some pinprick things reacting by the U.S. But there is another point I'd like to make, which I think is important in the Trump statement, which is used to, he parroted the comments that King Salman and Mohammed bin Salman, the son, has said, which is that Jamal Khashoggi was linked to the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, whether or not that's true, I don't know, but the Muslim Brotherhood is the real danger for the Saudis, and that's why they hate it so much, because it offers a political Islam but with democratic rights and elections and proper political parties and so on, which is why they wanted to see it destroyed in Egypt, why they're against Qatar, because Qatar helps the Muslim Brotherhood, why they've now got bad relations with Turkey, because Turkey is, in a sense, very similar to the Muslim Brotherhood, having an Islamic democratic political party in power. So that is another element in why the Saudis are so against Khashoggi.
Let's go back to Tehran here. I want to stay with the issue of Yemen here. What is it going to, it looks like there's just no political will, because we have the defense secretary in the United States, Mattis. He's again saying that there will be talks in December. But it sounds like it's just the can gets keep getting kicked down the road. I mean, there's no political will in Washington to stop the Saudis and their surrogates destroying Yemen. What does the United States get out of that? What does the West in general get out of a destroyed Yemen, where it's basically moving towards a form of genocide? Go ahead, in Tehran.
So instability and war in the Middle East is good for Washington in the short term, because, I mean, they sell billions of dollars of weapons to the Saudis. So the Saudis being involved in war is actually good for business. And I think that's something that Donald Trump made very clear in his recent statement, essentially saying that this is part of the America First policy, where, you know, the Saudis can get away with what they're doing because they're bringing jobs and money to the United States.
Well, I would really contest that, okay? The deals that he's talking about are in the pipeline. Mm-hmm. They're not even really signed. I mean, the bombs and the planes, they all came from the Bush-Obama era. And Trump has had zero impact on arms sales to Saudi Arabia at this point. I'll give you the last word in Tehran. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I would totally agree with that, that Trump is an expert in exaggerating numbers. But I would say that even if those numbers were true, in the long run, this kind of policy of supporting an aggressive dictator like MBS is going to be bad for U.S. interests. The Saudis have fomented a lot of instability and terrorism in the region. I mean, when the rise of a group such as ISIS, which came out of the illegal invasion of Iraq, essentially had a Wahhabi ideology. 12 books out of the books that ISIS officially published,
I have to jump in here. Okay, we've run out of time. Many thanks to my guests in Tehran, Leeds, and London. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.